Decades of abuse by the late presenter Jimmy Savile says he escaped justice by effectively grooming the nation.
Savile was one of the UK's most prolific, predatory and opportunist serial sex offenders.
That's Commander Peter Spindler from the Metropolitan Police, who says Savile committed more than 200 criminal offences against adults and children as young as 8. Another review also admits that prosecutors could have charged him. Caroline Moore was abused by Savile when she was a patient at Stoke Mandeville Hospital in the 70s.
It's so shocking what has been allowed to happen here, and to make it worse, it was still going on in 2009. It's just awful.
Other news, there's bad news on the jobs front. The collapsed photography chain Jessop's is to close all its stores with the loss of more than 1,300 jobs. Honda says it's shedding 800 posts at its plant in Swindon, with London Fire Brigade announcing plans to cut 520 posts. 6 men are in hospital and one of them's critically ill after taking a hallucinogenic drug called 2CB. The group from Newcastle are thought to have bought the Class A drug over the internet. Wintry showers are expected to sweep across the country this weekend, bringing up to 4 inches of snow in some places. The Met Office has issued a yellow warning of severe weather for the whole of southern England tomorrow. And the first official portrait of the Duchess of Cambridge has been unveiled, but it's received a decidedly mixed reaction.
I don't know if I like it. I think it makes her look a bit older than she is.
Her eyes aren't dancing in a way that we've become used to.
Looking at it at first glance, it's not the most flattering, but it's got a certain something.
Kate says she's delighted with it, but art critics have been scathing, branding it dull and complaining it looks like she's grimacing rather than smiling. That's the latest. I'm Matt Steele.
BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Horfield and former Lib Dem candidate for the Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner, Pete Levy. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the man the NSPCC have called Britain's most dangerous and prolific child molester ever, Jimmy Savile, spent 11 successive New Year's Eves at Chequers, the most powerful residence in the land, as a guest of Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. And today's police report on the 450 abuse crimes Jimmy Savile committed and the 34 known rapes begs the question, why was none of this published or reported in Britain's so-called free press, nor noticed by the police until after he was dead? Then there is also Lord McAlpine's case. Evidence of McAlpine's innocence of paedophilia involvement has still not been tested in court. Chris Patten's BBC caved in and settled out of court. The BBC is, of course, heavily implicated in Savile's paedophilia, allowing sexual assaults to take place on BBC premises. And then there's also our own Bristol case of BBC presenter and child molester Peter Rowell, now in jail, who was also one of Prince Charles's ambassadors entrusted with assessing young people as part of the Prince's Trust Scheme. So today, maybe some closure for the victims and their families, where they're still alive, but still no justice. Plus, have you ever wondered why so many people in authority in this country, or in Wales anyway, seem unable or unwilling to do their job properly? Well, you're not the only one. And Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius and some showers. This weekend, highs of 3 Celsius. Wet and windy on Saturday with some possible snow overnight. Gosh, snow. Colder, but drier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius. Feeling very cold this week with some possible snow midweek, warming up towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of January, highs of 7 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Horfield and former Lib Dem candidate for Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner, Pete Levy. Hi, Pete. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be back.
The midterm relaunch of Clegg, let's just start there. That's happened this week with the coalition government. We're about halfway through the term now. Now, these politicians, I'm afraid, when they come across to me, they come across more like salesmen than politicians. What's your thoughts about Nick Clegg as a leader of your Lib Dem party? Is he the right person to take the party into the next general election?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and I think that one that will crop up time and time again. My visibility to that level of politics is obviously very limited. I'm a Hawfield resident and a resident of Bristol and a Bristol City Councillor, so I don't get to see that level of personality. However, during the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, I did get to meet a lot of our ministers, actually cross-party, and I think sometimes those that could be the best at their jobs might not necessarily be the best at presenting and selling themselves in public. Anyone that watched Question Time last night and the Dean Norris would have seen the extremes there. I do, on the few occasions that I have met Nick Clegg, I have found him to be approachable. I think that the coalition with the Conservatives is one that a lot of Liberal Democrats, certainly Liberal Democrat voters, were unhappy with. It is what it is, and we've got to get on and stop some of those things happening that we don't want to happen, that we don't think is in the best public interest.
The trouble is, approachable isn't enough. I mean, you want someone to be trusted and show that they're sort of an honourable person. I mean, a used car salesman is approachable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's our local ministers, you know, like Tessa Munt down in Wales, and Steve Webb, and even Charlotte Leslie and Kerry McCarthy. These are the people that I've had visibility to, and I have to say, I've found them all to be very approachable. I think, you know, I think that their hearts are in the right place, and they believe in what they believe in, and it's that level of approachability. I think, you know, when you get to Westminster, I hate to use that, and I'll use it only once, it's out of my pay grade.
Because the thing is, I mean, these are the people who, I mean, it must, you know, massively affect the way people vote locally. We've got local elections here in May this year. We didn't, I think, have any last May, but this year we have. I think, isn't it, a third of the council is elected every 4 years, and so we have a year off, which is a bit of a crazy system, a strange system, not necessarily crazy. You know, that affects your ability to get a vote. Yeah, so you've got an interest in making sure that your leader is trusted by the population and is going to get you votes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I know probably as well as anyone else, I stood for election across Somerset, South Gloucester and Bristol for the Police and Crime Commissioner. I believed that I was the right candidate for the job, but I also believed that the majority of people that did turn out, and there was, you know, less than 20%, voted on national politics rather than on us as individuals. And I think that's why we saw that, as it was dubbed, Independence Day, regardless necessarily of skill sets or whether they were the right people for the job. And I understand that. I've only been a local councillor for 2.5 years. Prior to that, I had no political involvement whatsoever. So as a voter, I've been shouting at the radio and TV as well as the next person.
Well, at Nick as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I think you sometimes, as a normal man of the street, you know, I've got no sort of hotline to Westminster, and you watch, you know, you've only got to watch Question Time, and I have to be careful that I'm nowhere near Twitter or Facebook or a telephone, because that's very dangerous.
So, yes, I take it you watched Question Time last night. It was quite a fiery edition of Question Time, actually, with John Bird from the Big Issue saying a few truths and actually getting cheers. I mean, you don't often hear that in the background of the Question Time, which was being filmed in South London, in Lewisham, I believe, where there's about to be an accident and emergency centre and possibly even large parts of the NHS closed down in that area. Someone made the point there that this is a poor area, and it looks like that what this government is doing possibly is making sure the NHS survives quite happily and the hospitals are doing very well in the richer areas where their voters are, but abandoning some of the poorer areas. Now, that's not good for you, and that's not good for you getting your votes, because you're seen as part of those sorts of decisions.
Yeah, I mean, if only that were true. I mean, you know what, I think the one phrase that I'm really fed up with hearing is, we're all in this together. Well, actually, Mr. Osborne, I'd like to be in your situation and consider us all in this together. You know, I stood for election in the first place because I want to make sure that when my kids go to school, they're safe. I want to make sure that people don't keep parking on double yellow lines. I want to make sure that people don't jump red lights. I want to make sure that we've got enough police and community safety officers on our streets to keep us safe. That's the bottom line. And it's people, you know, it's people like Neighbourhood Watch, and it's people like the voluntary sector, it's Vosca, it's Bristol Rape Crisis, it's all these organisations. We're the people that keep our safe street, and we expect people in central government to protect our interests. Now, the problem is, you know, every time if we read a story about corruption or expenses, our heads just go down that little bit more, because we have to say, you're there to represent us properly. I know this from personal experience. You know, we were talking before we came on air, and, you know, this whole issue about police and crime commissioners, I was really opposed to it. I couldn't see the point of it. £75 million it cost. What was wrong with the old system? Because a couple of ministers thought it would be good to change to an American system. I stood because, you know, once we'd voiced our concern and said it's a crazy idea, it's not going to help us, you know, once the government had forced it through and it become legislation, you've then got to stand up and go, you know what, you can knock us down, but we'll keep getting up and coming back and putting our case forward.
Yeah, the other thing is that you've got a background in policing, haven't you? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I joined, I'm the oldest of five, and it was that case of, you know, once you're old enough to leave school, you've got to get out, because, you know, the bigger you get, the more you eat. I joined Wiltshire as a police cadet, so I'm a big fan of the police cadet system. I spent 2 years in Salisbury and in Corsham in Devizes, went to police training college, and then did... joined Devizes Borough as a police officer. I was bussed in one evening to St Paul's, early 80s, for the riots, and it made me realise that actually I needed to get more life experience. I left the police force and transferred, and then spent 6 years with the Royal Military Police. And that's my policing background. Since I've been at council, I don't necessarily like all elements of local politics. I like the idea of mixing with like-minded individuals who want to change and make things better in the areas that we live. But the real antidote to all of that for me was serving on the police authority, cross-party with independent members, with career police officers, and making sure that across Devon and Somerset and in Bristol, you know, we had the best police service possible, and actually we held them to account. Now, only when you've done the job can you actually hold them, I believe, hold them to account properly, and make sure that issues such as Stokes Croft, that we make sure that any complaints against police are investigated properly, that anyone who is in custody is well looked after and well maintained.
Now, you say you work in Corsham. That's quite an interesting place to work. You've got about as much going on under the ground there as on top of it, haven't you?
Yeah, I know. It's a really bizarre situation, because you know, I remember during the PCC elections, I raised the issue of female genital mutilation, and someone, a reporter, said to me, "But what's that got to do with farmers in Somerset?" It's got everything to do with farmers in Somerset, because it means that even if you are part of a rural community, and it's an issue that affects just a small group of people.
Well, I'm not talking about farmers, I'm talking about these underground military installations. Were you policing those?
I was trying to be secretive then, Tony. No, we weren't. That was as a civil copper, that was at the time, that was all part and parcel of military intelligence, and something that I obviously know nothing about. I've never heard of it before.
Anything about the Corsham Computer Centre and the fact that it's linked up to NATO in Brussels and running wars by remote control. But anyway, on to another subject, which I wanted to bring up particularly because of your policing experience, and that is a story which came out last year on Channel 4 News, Friday the 30th of March, around about Easter time to be precise, with Andy Davis. And this is a really shocking bit of evidence, and also particularly worrying, because this report by the Serious Organised Crime Agency hadn't come out since 2008. A copy of it was handed to Andy Davis, but none of it had come out at all. And it's about something which the Serious Organised Crime Agency were calling Project Riverside. So let's have a little listen now to an extract from that report from last year before we get your comments, Pete.
This is a story about deleting intelligence, trying to get witness names, infiltrating police operations and corrupt cops. A story which, as we can now reveal, was told privately by the serious organised crime agency SOCA to the Home Office 4 years ago. It came in the form of a confidential 8-page report, the details of which have never been disclosed publicly before. You can't access it through the Freedom of Information Act, but I've now been shown a copy. And what is so alarming about this report is not what it says about the threat posed by private investigators to people's privacy. It's what it says about the very serious threat some private investigators have posed to the criminal justice system. The confidential report by SOCA is entitled Private Investigators, the Rogue Element of the Private Investigation Industry and Others Unlawfully Trading in Personal Data. It's dated January 2008, and it warns about unscrupulous members of the private investigation industry providing specialist services to serious organized criminals. SOCA analyzed five law enforcement operations under what they called Project Riverside. Two operations they discovered showed private investigators involved in the following: accessing the police national computer to perform unauthorized checks, accessing internal police databases, including those containing serving officers' private details, accessing details of current investigations against a criminal or criminal group, and deleting intelligence records from law enforcement databases. And for that to have happened, they would have needed the help of corrupt serving police officers.
A pretty shocking report, I think you'd agree, Pete.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, what hope is there for detectives trying to do their job when they turn up on a Monday morning and find that evidence that they've been painstakingly gathering over months, possibly, has simply been deleted off the system?
I think the problem is that technology is moving so fast that actually I can hear people, as we were listening to that report then, I can hear listeners saying, oh, actually this is the stuff of you know, TV dramas and it's made up. Well, actually, I would beg to differ. I think that these occasions are exceptions to the rule. I think, you know, having been one and knowing them, I think the huge majority of coppers, police staff and volunteers, you know, it's a vocation, it's not a job. They do it because they want to do it, and they are more hacked off than anyone when you get those very few rotten apples. I think that there are checks and balances in place. I can only speak with regards to limited knowledge of Avon and Somerset, but I think, you know, we've only seen the tip of the iceberg with regards to the hacking inquiry. There's big money involved with this, and I think that every time police and intelligence services make an advance, then the criminal element will stay ahead of that. And so that goes on and on and on. And I think that we have to be aware of this. But I'd want all of this to be out in the open as far as is practical. Get the Home Secretary involved. We don't want anything hidden. I think we've seen with the Savile case today. We've had enough of these sort of stories being buried. They need to be out in the open, and as you alluded to before, only when that's proven and when that's happened will we as members of the public actually be confident in the people that are looking after us, and will they be confident in the system that they're working within.
I noticed in a report in The Independent about somewhere called Elm Road Guest House, where alleged paedophile activities were going on in South West London, that the police officers involved in that case had decided to make absolutely no records of anything of what they were doing on any computer system, to just simply paper copies and keep various copies of their paper investigation files in various different places, keeping it well away from the national computer.
Shocking. That, you know, the key to all of this is sharing intelligence and communication. It's effective communication, I think, if everyone knows what's going on. This is why Bristol's leading the way with regards to its integrated offender management scheme, because actually you've got voluntary sector, you've got local authorities, you've got police, you've got probation service, all working together, sharing intelligence, sharing information. Only when that's done, no person is an island, no organisation is an island, and we need to make sure that if we've got these systems, these technological systems, that we use them and we use them properly. But actually the other side of that is with regards to confidentiality and the protection of information and individuals, and we need to make sure they're as robust and as secure as possible. When I my last posting in the army was with the Central Criminal Records and Intelligence Office of the Royal Military Police that was linked into New Scotland Yard's computer. And actually, you know, the information was input, and we had to make sure that it was as secure as possible and all the information was as clean as possible.
Problem is, of course, that one of the things that was being talked about in this report was that that even police officers' personal details themselves were being accessed by organised crime. I mean, this is pretty frightening. Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, do you want to comment on this Soccer report? Because I find it particularly shocking and annoying, actually, that since 2008 this report has stayed secret.
Yeah, I think that is obviously, you know, we want more transparency, but I don't think people should be that shocked by these kind of things coming out. This is what happens. Organised criminals are very well funded, and they've got a very high level of motivation. And one of their main targets, I mean, I used to work in Eastern Europe, and you ran across lots of criminal groups all the time, and their main targets are to corrupt police officers. And of course, in many of these Eastern countries, police officers are rather badly paid. They're, you know, they're way down the pecking order, and the temptation to go along with this is always going to be there, and that's why you've got to have checks and balances and internal audit and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
On to our next story. Police officers found guilty of trying to sell information. You might have noticed I've been focusing on police stories this week, Pete. Found guilty of trying to sell information to the News of the World. April Casburn offered details of the phone hacking inquiry to the News of the World tabloid. She's the first person convicted as a result of a £40 million investigation. Detective Chief Inspector April Casburn, 53, was found guilty of misconduct in public office at Southwark Crown Court after a jury decided she'd tried to sell information from the phone hacking inquiry. I mean, for me, Pete, I don't know what your thoughts are. The big thing here is nothing to do with her trying to sell information. It's actually about tipping off criminals that an investigation is going on against them, which is essentially perverting the course of justice.
Yeah, it is, and also I think it's undermining a lot of the good solid work that good, honest, decent coppers are doing. I mean, that's the sad thing for me. I mean, April was a detective chief inspector. You don't get to be a detective chief inspector overnight. It's something that's hard earned, and I'm sure that she would have done a lot of good work during her career. But the thing is what we need to do is we need to make sure that there are, as Martin alluded to before, that there are checks and balances in place to make sure that this doesn't happen. And actually, do you know what? It's people on the other side of the... It will be people, you know, why did she suddenly decide? I'd like to know more. Why did she suddenly decide that she was going to sell that? Was it on a whim? Was there some pressure applied?
Well, one of the reasons, apparently, was that she was being bullied at work, that she was the only person in the office that didn't have her own desk. I mean, you can see that if she's not happy in her job, that someone sort of comes along and puts their arm around her like a Murdoch employee or, you know, maybe a news editor of the News of the World, then she's likely to, her heart is not in her job anymore, then she's likely to be more loyal to somebody else. This is why police morale is so important.
Yeah, police morale is actually at an all-time low. We know that. You know, we've watched the Windsor, we've watched Hutton, we've watched all of these. It undermines the reason that coppers get out of bed in the morning and go to work and actually deal with things that none of us in this studio would want to see ever. And I think, you know, and I've experienced this myself, people will swear at you, spit at you and call you all the names under the sun, but the minute that they need your help, you're the person that they turn to. And that's what police officers and staff and volunteers have to put up with. And I think that's why we need to make sure that they've got the resources, they've got the support, and they've got all the checks and balances in place to make sure that they are looked after. And I certainly think, I mean, I can only speak with regards to Avon and Somerset, but I certainly think it comes from the top, and we've got a good chief officer group, very good strategic director of HR, a very good group of district commanders, but we need to make sure that we tell them what we want and to make sure that actually we do watch what they're doing.
Martin, Mr. Justice Fulford warned Casburn, a mother of three, that she faced an immediate custodial sentence, and the Metropolitan Police said she had betrayed the service and let down her colleagues. But Patrick Gibbs, QC, her counsel, asked the judge to take into account the fact that Casburn was in the process of adopting a child. I mean, there's all these peripheral sides to this, so it looks like she may not actually do time for this. It may be that she simply loses her job loses a career. I mean, is that enough, do you think? And is it I mean, it's a sort of halfway house to actually doing a jail sentence for what is essentially perverting the course of justice and misconduct in public office.
Well, I mean, that's for the judges to decide, isn't it? You know, I could easily sit here and say this, that and the other. They will know what the circumstances are. I do point out, she does say here, I felt very strongly that we shouldn't be doing hacking. Our function was to prevent terrorist attacks. So she was in a terrorist, anti-terrorist unit, and their resources were being used for the hacking inquiry. And that was what her source of upset was, that, you know, we shouldn't be, this is trivial, we're an anti-terrorist group. And but in any case, she should have known, if she's at that level, you can't be undermining other people's investigations like that. It's just totally unprofessional.
Well, I mean, I would have thought that complaint would be something she should be directing to her boss rather than to the news desk at
exactly.
The News of the World.
Yeah.
Next story, Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Colin Port. Well, that's been quite a fiery exchange this week. We've been in some of the national newspapers. Our local Chief Constable loses his court action against the new Police and Crime Commissioner Sue Mount-Stevens, in fact, who you were standing against, Pete, in the elections before Christmas, in November time, for the Police and Crime Commissioners. Sue Mount-Stevens, who was elected on November the 15th last year, faced claims that she raised her voice and slapped her hand on the table during a meeting 6 days later, leaving Mr. Port feeling shocked and humiliated. She denied asking him to quit, insisting he resigned unilaterally, but Mr. Port went to the High Court in London in an 11th hour bid to block recruitment of a successor, with candidates due to be interviewed on Thursday. That's this week. In fact, we should have an announcement about a new Chief Constable, which won't be Colin Port, because he's refused to reapply for his job next Wednesday. Martin?
Well, I mean, this is a rather sorry saga, isn't it? I think when the government decided that they were going to have police commissioners, if they've realised that the sort of basically disorganisation that might be that might flow from it, and that's not to take any side in this at all. It's just, you know, you've set yourselves up to fail here, haven't you? And we're starting to see, you know, failure.
The thing is, there's a new regime come in last November about how police senior police officers are appointed. So there's bound to be a little bit of jarring. I mean, Colin Port, I would imagine, would have hoped that he would just simply be able to renew his contract and carry on in the old-fashioned way. But there's a whole new system come in, and lots of maybe candidates that wouldn't have otherwise been considered are now being considered.
Well, yes, and it's all new, isn't it? We're making it all up as we go along, and you know, maybe this will be straightened out, but maybe it won't, because in actual fact, it just looks like a shambles, doesn't it?
Pete, I know you're on the panel, so you're limited in what you can say. But what are your comments about this story? It's been very, you know, it's nice to see that actually this has made some of the nationals this week, because I think it's quite an important precedence being set here about who is appointing, you know, and the idea that someone would have to go, that Sue has been taken to the High Court just literally 2 days before she's due to interview people for the job. It's extreme amount of pressure on her in her new job.
Yeah, it is an unfortunate set of circumstances. I mean, the good thing is Avon and Somerset can be very proud of what's been achieved. I know Colin Port, I've known him for the last 2.5 years as a member of the Police Authority. When he joined the service 2004-2005, recorded crime was way past 71,000. 2011-2012, it was 47,000. He's got a UN, Northern Ireland, a Yugoslav policing reputation, and he knows his stuff. Having said that, I've worked with Sue for the last 2.5 years, and I think that I have to be careful that I wouldn't criticise Sue, because whatever I say would sound like sour grapes. I think she's a good woman. She was good when she worked on the Police Authority. I'm sure that with the right support, she'll do an excellent job for the people of Avon and Somerset, as she said. My only concern with this is that I can't comment, because we weren't in the room at the time. It is a shame, and I think that we need to move on from this and make sure that whatever happens is we get the best for the people of Avon and Somerset.
Do you think Colin should just have reapplied for his job and put himself forward with all the other candidates that are being interviewed this week?
Difficult for me to answer that one, to be honest, Tony, because I wasn't there and wasn't party to that conversation. I don't know. I don't know what's in Sue's mind. If it were me, I suppose I would have had a conversation with the chief constable just to ascertain what his views are. But I think it's important, and so it's difficult for me to comment on that one specifically. But I think going around the country, this is the important thing. We want the best for Avon and Somerset. Now, we've got a situation, this crazy government situation of police and crime commissioners, which could lead, some may say, to unqualified and inexperienced individuals, for whatever reason, finding themselves in a position where they're responsible for policing in their area. We found ourselves with I think something like 20 chief officers, so that's chief constables, deputies and assistant chief constables, all ready to move, that couldn't move until these elections, which were delayed from May to November. And actually, you know, you have to move quite quickly to make sure that you attract and retain the best talent and they don't decide to go off and work somewhere else. I have to say, occasionally it works to our advantage in our area, because I know Gloucester have just appointed a new chief constable, who was deputy chief constable in Northamptonshire, and her credibility is huge, and she's very community minded. She's got a good track record, and I think that Gloucester have managed to attract a very good chief constable, and I hope that Avon and Somerset, we can do the same.
One thing has been said, though, is there's a lot of cronyism going on. Particularly, there's one case in South Wales where the Police and Crime Commissioner is a former police officer, superintendent, and he's collected around him as a staff in the Police and Crime Commissioner's office, basically lots and lots of his old work colleagues. And there's a lot of criticism in that area saying, well, look, actually, this is just simply the police policing the police. And in fact, there's no real independence outside the police anymore. And this is a real step back.
Yes.
I'm not sure which county that was. I can't remember which police force that was, but anyway, don't you think that's a danger too, that it all becomes rather like a little police club when people like yourself, who are former police officers, become you know, the public aren't going to look at that as you as an independent person, are they, outside the police, when you're an ex-policeman yourself?
I think they can. I mean, I'm 51 now. I could see the look of shock and surprise on your face there, Tony, but I am 51. I had a tough paper round. The thing is, you know, this was some time ago, my policing experience. I've been involved with media and television for the last 25 years. I've never once said a politically motivated comment in either side, actually, and I will hold the police to account, and I know that, you know, we know what the dodgy are, we know what the language is, and so I think that is a good thing. You know what, it really genuinely does scare me, some of the stories that are going on around the country at the moment. It would be unfair to say where it is, but there's a police and crime commissioner in Northamptonshire who's conservative, that's irrelevant, the youngest police and crime commissioner in the country, who I understand got rid of the staff that he inherited and bought in a whole new set of staff. And that, you know, some of his activities are very, very worrying indeed. We've got a situation in Derbyshire where the Police and Crime Commissioner went out, it appeared that it was an open and transparent case, went out to look for a deputy. And I think that PCCs should appoint deputies. I think where it's appropriate, it's a massive job, and I think that they should have someone with corresponding skills to work off.
Martin, old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers, what's your thoughts on the way this is going? I know you're not a big fan of it, but we have to live with these police and crime commissioners. It may not work, but what are your thoughts about Colin Port and whether he should have actually bitten the bullet and reapplied for his job like everyone else?
That's up to him, isn't it? I mean, I can't speak on his behalf. He decides whether he wants to apply for a job or not, doesn't he? I think the problem with this is, I think ultimately the next Labour government is going to abolish these police and crime commissioners, because we can see the problems already.
Yes, if there is a Labour government,
but the point is that we're in kind of damage and limitation mode here now. I mean, I think there's a consensus emerging here that this has been very badly thought through, and there's all kinds of problems emerging. So let's just take a deep breath and have another look at it is what I would suggest.
Benefit
cap. This is another story this week. Will hurt 7 million families. Plans to increase benefits by less than inflation, that's keeping them down to 1% whilst inflation is starting to take off, will make 7 million families, that's half of Britain's working households, worse off by an average of £165 a year, according to analysis by the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And landlords are also warning, in a press release, the Landlords Association is warning of homelessness too. Pete, let's have you first on this one. I mean, this is a vote taken in the Commons earlier this week to keep all benefits at a maximum of 1%. Now, this is even if inflation is up, you know, sort of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it may be even higher. It's basically forcing the poor down into poverty whilst they can, you know, get rather annoyed while they watch these bankers strutting around with their million-pound bonuses.
You know what? I mean, I'm not a fiscal expert, but you look at this sort of scenario, and we've got to do more to help individuals, you know, who aren't shirkers and skivers. I've got people living in my ward who do want to go back to work. They do want to go back and support their own families, and we've got to do everything we can. And
well, we know, for example, there's six people chasing every single job that's out there. I mean, you know, they can't all six get it, can they? And if they, I mean, if this does play into the hands of employers, because it means that there's a tremendous pressure downwards on wages.
Yeah, I think so. And also what we need to do is we need to, you know, it is about reinvesting and making sure that we do, you know, there's no green shoots. That's the problem. And what we need to do is we need to make sure that we do reinvest, that there is a climate. We know it's a tough time out there. We know the austerity measures. But actually, we need those green shoots to enable companies to start growing again. You know, we need to try and convince employers that young mums who you know, can, maybe kids are going back to, back to nurseries, who want to get back to work but don't want to work full-time, who want to work around childcare, the employers are actually encouraged to do that. That shares some of those jobs around. But especially in Bristol, we know that we've got elements of the community who don't have English as a first language. And it's tough enough for those of us with English as a first language to try and understand some of the ramifications and the form fillings and the protocols to try and claim benefit, what we're entitled to, what we're not entitled to. We need to make sure that we look after those people first and foremost, because actually, you know, that it's an issue, because there are some people that turn to crime. You know, we know shoplifting, with regards to shoplifters, they are going after, you know, there are stories of police officers. There was one in particular of a police officer who was called to a shoplifter and took him to a food bank rather than arresting him, because this guy clearly just wanted to feed his family, and we have to be compassionate and understand that.
Well, I mean, one of the things, for example, something happened to me this week, because I sign on, I'm a part-time worker, but I still sign on Job Seekers Allowance, get about £6 a week or something from it, and I turned up to sign on this week only to find that there was an interview that nobody told me about that I was supposed to have gone to before Christmas. You know, I would think at least expect the courtesy of being told that I had to actually come along to an interview, and they said, oh well, this interview that you weren't told about, you didn't come to it, so we've cut off your benefits, and now I've got to go through a whole process of reapplying for things like housing benefit, because you then get cut off from everything. It does seem to me that there's actually some sort of incentive on the Department for Work and Pensions at the moment to get as many people off these benefits as possible to show some good figures, and that, of course, what that does is that simply means that people don't have the money that they need, and you know, after, if that happens to you a few times, you're going to think, well, I'm going to go down, talk to the drug dealers down the road, because they're offering me some work. Martin?
Yeah, well, I think the politics of this are quite nasty, really, because the government didn't have to do this. I mean, this is the first time this has happened since the 1930s, a real terms cut in benefits. It's what crashed the Labour government in the 1920s. And this sort of thing. So it's actually deliberately chosen by the Conservatives, and they didn't have to have a vote on it either. If they could have just done it and said, this is what we're going to do, and they've done it on the back of this media campaign against scroungers and all the rest of it. But of course, the political trick was that they then thought they would put the Labour leadership on the spot, so that they could say, you know, we're for the workers, you're for the shirkers and all the rest of it. So you could, the politics of this are visceral and nasty. And for people who are on benefits, whether working or, because many people in work are on benefits, this is what the big Achilles heel of all of this is, as like yourself, Tony, for example. The fact is that making these people who are the most vulnerable to be the victims in this situation is bullying, basically. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Especially when we know that the LIBOR fixers and all the rest of it, their banks may pay some kind of a fine, but they will not be having their collars felt. And this is class war from the top. And Britain also has quite a tradition of class war from the bottom. So all I can say to the people doing this is wait until we've got the ball.
How long will we have to wait, Martin? We'll see. I mean, this sort of links to it. Bristol budget cuts, hundreds of council posts to be axed. It was quite a busy night Monday night here in Bristol. We had a new Labour leader elected and also the budget announced. Perfect timing, of course, for the Evening Post and their print deadlines. I don't know what that says about George Ferguson and his priorities in the new mayor. But anyway, hundreds of council jobs are expected to be axed as part of City Mayor George Ferguson's plans to cut £35 million from the civic budget. More than 300 posts will be shed from the council's 7,000 workforce, of which about 100 are likely to be compulsory redundancies. 70 of the posts are currently vacant and will not be filled. There will be more unfilled posts, and an estimated 100 staff will be redeployed. Mr. Ferguson said the posts will be lost from back office staff and management restructuring rather than frontline staff. Well, they always say that, Pete, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, I don't envy Mayor Ferguson in the slightest. I wouldn't like that job. And I think, going back to point Martin made earlier on, I'll make one political comment if I can. And this is no disrespect to my Conservative colleagues here in Bristol, but heaven help us if there wasn't. For me personally, as a voter, I'd rather we not be in a Tory coalition. Having said that, people on a higher pay grade than me try to explain to me why we are. What would they be doing if we weren't there to try and stop them? But actually, I am fed up with every time some of these bad stories break. The Conservative ministers pointing at the Lib Dems, saying, well, it's, let's blame them, and not taking any responsibility themselves. Let's be honest, this isn't Bristol's fault. This isn't our fault that we've got to make all these cuts, or rather that the mayor's got to make all these cuts. It's handed down from central government. We know for a fact, let's take the police, I'll go back to that because that's my own point of reference, over 4 years had to make £43 million worth of cuts, in addition to which what I believe is an immoral and potentially illegal damping process costing Avon and Somerset an extra £20 million a year. And actually, I know that I've challenged the mayor, and I know that he will take that challenge on board, and he's now said that he will revisit police and community support officers. 32, he has got to make some tough decisions. I don't envy him those, and all I ask is that actually he does consult, and my understanding is that he will do that.
Martin, this is the cuts policy really kicking in, isn't it? Among the most controversial cuts are a 3-year plan to close a total of 6 residential care homes, provide 3 homes for people with dementia and 3 care homes which will be privately run, and that will save £1.7 million. No more funding for 32 police community support officers, and I understand that that's being renegotiated at the moment, Pete. Who are currently funded by the council. Then introducing car park charges at Blaise and Albury Court estates, and higher charges for long stay parking at Ashton Court. I mean, that's relatively uncontroversial. Stopping plans to build a new swimming pool for East Bristol at Brunel Academy. That's going to save apparently £350,000. Martin, it does seem that when we elect a political leader like George Ferguson, all he's really doing is he's managing a slow collapse.
Yes, which, I mean, I was opposed to having elected mayors for exactly this reason. So we've elected a mayor, and say the Labour Party candidate Marvin Rees had won, he would have had exactly the same problems to face, because in actual fact the mayor hasn't got any power. So we've got all this stupid, shall we have a mayor? Well,
it's not really the leadership.
In actual fact, they've got no power to do anything.
It's not really the leadership that we're looking for, is it? This is managing a retreat, basically.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, whoever was the mayor, and I put this to George as well, if Marvin had won, I think it would have been fairly clear he'd been saying this, we're going to have to carry out cuts. We're not going to do like Liverpool Council in the 80s and not set a rate and all the rest of it. That's not the way to go. Because we went down that road before and it didn't go anywhere. But, been there and done it and got the T-shirt. But whoever is running Bristol has got a voice in the country. You say, well, we are going to cut. We're going to do our best to try and negotiate with who we're going to cut and what's going to go. But what I want to hear from the Mayor of Bristol, and George is the Mayor of Bristol, loud and clear, this cuts policy at national level is national suicide. There is no case whatever for cutting public expenditure at this moment, and the Labour leadership is still shilly-shallying about this. You can't cut your way out of a crash. And once the crash comes, all this stuff about cuts will be jejun. It'll be yesterday's news. Because what will happen is the budget deficit will explode when there is a crash, because that's what happens. These people are economic illiterates.
Hmm. Tory councillor Jeff Gollop is a member of Mr Ferguson's cabinet, and he runs his own accountancy firm. He's charged with the task of overseeing the council's finances and said nobody enter politics to make cuts. So he said, we do see the importance of managing and controlling the budget so that we get the best value for money that we possibly can. Also, former council leader Simon Cook, cabinet member in charge of leisure and culture, said the overall impact of the cuts would be a lot less than was originally feared. Now, essentially, Pete, this is Simon's budget, because George Ferguson was only very recently elected. Most of this budget, if not 90% of it, has all been prepared by Simon Cook and your party.
Well, you know, I wasn't a member of the cabinet. I'm councillor for Horfield, and you know, I don't always have visibility as we refer backbench councillors to that level of detail. We do get to say, you know, what goes on in our own patches, and I think.
What about this business Martin was pointing out there about? Do you think George Ferguson should be a little bit tougher about defending Bristol from these cuts from the national policy? He's essentially saying, yes, you know, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it as cut as few frontline services as possible, mitigate the circumstances. But he's not questioning the actual necessity for these cuts in the first place.
Well, I think we've asked him to do that anyway. I think, there's only so many hours in the day. There's only so much he can do. You know what it is, Tony? I think it's communication. That's what I would ask, because the people of Bristol, you know, they'll hear something from us. They'll read something in the Post. They'll hear something on the BBC. Let's tell them, frankly, openly and honestly, what we're doing and explaining the rationale behind it. Now, 32 PCSOs. There are still people being attacked. There are still people living in fear of their own safety on the streets of Bristol right now. We need to explain to people, actually, we're going to, you know, if the mayor's having to cut funding for 32 PCSOs, and I do accept the point that he makes, and that is that no other core city funds PCSOs to the extent that Bristol does. My point, and the mayor has taken this on board, is the fact that we're at where we're at. We can't go back historically. That's not a reason to suddenly stop it. We need to make sure that in areas like St Paul and Eastern, that the police and PCSOs are from that community and can communicate with that community.
So do you think you're going to be able to keep those PCSOs? You think you're going to win that little battle with George?
I think it's a big battle. I don't think it's a big battle with George. I think that what we need to do is we need to talk to the police. And we need to go back and we need to say to the PCC, you promised during the election to go to central government and say, give us back our £20 million that you're taking every single year. Stop cuts. Make sure that we can turn that recruitment tap on. Because actually, if you could replace PCSOs with police officers, if you could provide a career structure for PCSOs, I know in my ward in Horfield, I had a superb PCSO who couldn't join the police, so joined British Transport Police. Now, we lost him. You know, my residents in my ward are talking about, you know, antisocial behaviour. They're talking about kids playing truant. They're talking about illegal parking. You know, if you take PCSOs out of the equation, who's going to do that? If anyone, it's going to be police officers.
It sounds to me like an argument that it's really important that you do win. Martin, what about the overall necessity for these cuts? If you were sitting in George Osborne's shoes, because clearly this is not something which is being decided here in Bristol. This is something which is being handed down from on high, from Westminster. What would you do if you were in Osborne's shoes? Because ultimately, there isn't enough money. That's what we keep being told.
Well, that's what we keep being told. I mean, let's make the point that whoever's running Bristol should be entering the national conversation about these cuts. And if we'd won, if Marvin Rees had won, he'd still have to carry through cuts.
Yep.
But of course, he would have been shouting on his soapbox, this is all wrong. And of course, that's the whole point.
But what would he be doing instead? What policies would he be putting forward?
Well, I mean, as you know, I think the interesting thing from Labour in Bristol, what we were interested in was social housing. And I believe that Ron Stone and others are still talking to George about the possibility of being able to raise some funding for social housing. So in other words, let's try and be constructive within the constraints of the situation.
But what about actually finding more money to spend in the first place for these PCSOs,
etc.? What are you going to find? You know what's going to happen in this new year? Britain's going to lose its credit rating. its AAA credit rating, which is what we've been, all of these cuts are supposed to preserve our AAA credit rating, but we're going to lose it. And you know why? Because austerity doesn't work. Ask the Greeks.
So what would you do? It's the third time I've asked you now. What would you do if you were in Osborne's shoes?
Well, what you do, in fact, what they should have done 4 years ago, is if you're going to rescue the banking system, you've then got to say, right, certain sections of the community have done very well out of this bubble, and the bubble goes back to the 1980s. So certain people started off as millionaires and ended up as billionaires, because we actually deregulated the system to allow that to happen. Then it all crashed and went down the drain. Now, at that point, what you've got to do is turn around to the wealthy investing classes and say, right, we're going to have a one-off wealth tax on you. We're going to take your money off you and pump it back into the system to reboot the economy.
But is that,
and that's the only way to get around this.
Is that something you could do now, or would you have had to do that in 2008?
The problem was, when the crash happened, the Labour leadership in government were away with the fence.
But we know what the problem is, Martin. What do we do now? You're talking about clawing this money back.
I'll tell you what we don't do now. What's happened this week, which annoys
tell
me.
Tell us what we do now, not what we don't do.
David Miliband has re-emerged from the grave, as it were. He did come and help us knock on doors during the mayoral election, actually. But he what Ed Balls is saying is he doesn't necessarily accept all these cuts are necessary. Yeah? Now, in fact, he's wrong. He should actually be saying we're not having any cuts at all, because of course it's all airy fairy anyway. Because
so you're essentially saying
power.
That Osborne should be raising this money from the rich right now, closing tax.
Absolutely, in many ways, a Tory government would be the people to read them the Riot Act. A certain kind of Tory government, if Jeff Gollop
but
was
not,
running,
not necessarily a government of millionaires, they're not going to do that, are they?
No, they aren't. But you know, Roosevelt was a millionaire in the 1930s in the US. He came from the very top drawer, and he said, Wall Street hates me and I welcome their hate. I'm doing my job properly.
Okay, so
and
how
the Tory government could have actually taken that line if they were so inclined.
Before we hear from Pete, how is this going to pan out then?
What's going to happen is there's a kind of happy talk going on about, you know, the economy's recovering, the recovery. We've got a fiscal cliff US debt problem. We've got the euro crisis still not over by any stretch of the imagination, because the austerity being forced on Spain and Portugal and Italy is actually increasing the budget deficit. Our budget deficit as a proportion of GDP is increasing, which is why we're going to lose our credit rating. And you know where this is all going? It's going towards a crash, a real crash, not a pretend crash, a real crash. And this, of course, is because capitalism, as it's been managed in the last 30 years, doesn't work.
Now, Pete, I know you're used to sort of chatting to people in Horfield about parking things, but I mean, obviously, this macroeconomic stuff is important. What's your view on it?
I think what you've got to do is you've got to look after people and you've got to talk to them. I think residents, you know, I've seen this, fed up with party politics. They're fed up with, you know, with the Osborne, with the Clegg, with the Cameron arguments that are going on, and people taking different sides. What they want to know is, how's that going to affect me? Is that going to mean that I'm going to get my kid into school? Does that mean that it's going to be proper school places? And I think that's the problem. Am I going to keep my job? You're absolutely right. And I do genuinely think that we do need to work together in Bristol. And we need to go, you know what? We've got a brilliant community here. We've got some great skills. We've got some great resources. Let's work together and make sure that we do attract that employment. I remember, as part of a project that I did with my day job hat on a couple of years ago, speaking to Professor David May. And he said, if you want to employ the best people, then you put your company where the best people want to live. And you know what? That's Bristol. We moved down out of London 15 years ago. And I think that Bristol is a superb place. We need to embrace that, and we need to work with communities and make sure that they understand what we're doing and get their feedback as well.
In an article by Jeremy Corbyn in the Morning Star this week, he finishes up by saying, a welfare state is not necessarily socialism, but it is a step in the right direction of a society based on need rather than greed. The Tories have shown their contempt for the poor. It's up to Labour to stand with the poor majority rather than the wealthy minority. Another effect of the cuts, we're doing quite a lot of this today, is the spelling disaster for our crowded jails. Gloucester Jail and Shepton Mallet Jail, Pete, looks like are going to be closing within the next few months. One of these Titan jails. A super jail being opened up, no one's quite sure where.
It's short-sighted, isn't it? Again, like everything else. I mean, one of the things that I was talking about during the PCC elections was rehabilitation of offenders. Why do people offend? Get them there, you know, in Horfield prison, that, you know, they've got some cracking projects that will get some of these offenders off of that treadmill. You know, youngsters getting involved in crime. What we need to do is we need to provide as many exit points off of that treadmill as we can. There are some superb voluntary organisations in Bristol that are doing just that.
But they're saying the voluntary sector is failing at the moment. This is another announcement today. The voluntary sector around the country and charitable organisations are saying that they're finding it very, very difficult just to raise the money now in order to survive, to get through the day, to pay the rent, to pay the phone bill.
Yeah, I was listening to Matthew Simmons from Vosca actually this morning talking to Don Foster about this, and Don's view was that, you know, it's not quite as bad as it's painted, but actually what we need to do is we need to get all these voluntary sector organisations, because they all touch each other and they all overlap, is get them working together and helping them and providing a hub. And that's what I want, that's what I'm hoping that Sue will do.
Well, I understand they're doing that actually down at the Southfield Centre, Beauty Road, in a couple of weeks' time. Yeah. Martin, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I mean, I'm talking about specifically. I think you got hit the nail on the head there. This is short-sighted.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, these are false economies. The treatment is killing the patient, basically. I mean, that's the line that the Labour leadership are taking. I don't encourage them to talk about the crash. I do that.
Yeah.
Their job is just to play within the rules of what ordinary people understand. But as a Labour activist at grassroots, I want influence over these people who are leading my party. You do realise that there could be a crash, and we want a plan B.
Okay, Martin, we've only got a couple of minutes left.
Not like it was last time.
Another story, retiring this year. Well, then you'll be spending... You'll be £3,400 worse off than those who stopped working 5 years ago. This is a massive change in the return that our pension pots are giving us, basically due to quantitative easing. Martin, can you explain what's going on here? Ultimately, if you stopped working 5 years ago, you'd be £3,400 a year better off, because the quantitative easing is massively eroding what people's savings.
Yeah, I mean, this is on average, of course. You know, for per head. Quantitative easing, which we were told was a stopgap measure, is now going to go on to infinity. And at a certain point, the markets will panic, and then there'll be a crash. That's what will happen.
Pete, what do you think about this? I mean, this is really a kind of theft by the bankers, isn't it? I mean, you know, people have saved their money, and yet £3,400 of it every year, the amount that you're getting, your annuity from your pension every year, is disappearing into their pockets.
Yeah, I think that we are living longer. We are leading more active lives as we come up to retirement age, and I think what we need to do is, and I nearly used a rude word there, and I know I shouldn't, but actually it is the bankers, and we need to make sure that as a voter, what it seems to me is that we never blooming learn from these people that are keeping us in the dark and taking our money and investing wrongly. What we need to do is we need to have more visibility. We need more people to go, actually, we're not having that. We'll hold them to account. They will pay for this, and we will punish them to stop it happening in the future. Because when I retire, I want to make sure, if I'm around that long, that actually I do get those resources, that there are the care homes in place for me, that there is affordable transport, there is affordable housing. We need to make sure that actually that's there for us.
Deutsche Bank made a huge bet and profit on LIBOR. This is the Wall Street Journal on the 9th of January. Deutsche Bank AG made 2.4%, made at least €500 million, that's $654 million in profit in 2008 from trades pegged to the interest rates, under investigation by regulators worldwide. International bank documents show the German bank's trading profits resulted from billions of euros in bets released to the London Interbank Offered Rate or LIBOR. Martin, they're profiting massively out of this, and it seems nothing's being done. But our final story this week is the mannequin. Your Aberdeen mannequin candidate acquitted of election fraud. Renee Slate entered a mannequin as a candidate in Aberdeen City Council elections. She's an Aberdeen woman, and she's been charged after a mannequin was entered as a candidate in last year's City Council election, but she's now been acquitted. Renee Slater was taken to court over the name Helena Torrey being put forward to stand in the May election. She was charged under the Representation of the People Act and went on trial at Aberdeen Sheriff Court this week. She later told BBC Scotland she'd wanted to represent the voice of the silent majority in the Tory area of Aberdeen. She's a former Labour councillor. Do you think that maybe, Pete, there's going to be a new party set up around this idea of getting mannequins to stand in our local and general elections?
There could be well-dressed mannequins. You know what? I think that, you know, sometimes there's a lot of serious stuff going on and our heads come down, and occasionally we just need something to just lift our spirits and go, you know what, maybe she's got a point. It's got us talking about it, and I don't think that you can judge people. This is my opinion. You can't always judge people by the colour of one or two different colour badges that they wear.
Okay, that's all for now. We're back after the news, the Murdoch News at 6.
Committed more than 200 criminal offences across 6 decades.